As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
On today's episode of The Audible, Bruce and I talk about our top 25 coaches rankings that went up on The Athletic this week, and we answer your questions in the mailbag. That's coming up next on The Audible. Presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined as always by Bruce Feldman, and we have a special episode for you tied to a special set of columns that we put out on The Athletic on Thursday.
Stu, I think this argument that we have been having for our top 25 coaches, I started doing it last year. You've been doing it for many years, and I think I feel like it kind of grew out of you would post this, and then I, as I'm not always proud to do, but I feel like I nitpick your stuff, and I did, and I feel like the part where it started was I think you had at one point Clay Helton in the top 15, and
no, that never ever happened, but
top 25 somewhere, and I think we went down the list and you were like, well, you would have him in your top 40, wouldn't you? And I was like, I don't know. And I feel like that was like the put up or shut up. So I needed to do my list.
I do remember that now. Yeah, you would constantly go on there and criticize my coaches list. I said, well, why don't you do one then? And we did them both for the first time last year. And now we have one this year. And I think, you know, before we get into some specific names, I think we both noticed that what I refer to as kind of a brain drain in the coaching profession right now, because there are so many guys who just in the last couple years, two years ago, right, you would have had Urban Meyer in your top 10, Chris Peterson in your top 10. I know I had Mark D'Antonio in my top 10, and none of them are in college football anymore. You've got other people like Gary Patterson and David Shaw who have been very highly ranked, at least in mine in the past, who have fallen on hard times recently. So
you also had a guy who would have been in our probably top 15, maybe even top 10, Matt Rhule, go to the NFL.
That's exactly right. So for me, the top six or seven, probably top seven, were pretty easy. And then it was just like, well, what do I do now? Like, I've got a list here. I've got more than 25 names I'd love to have on the list, but I don't know that any of these I want to put number 9 or number 10. So before we get into these names, and we're not going to go through the whole list, but hit some of the highlights. How do you go about doing this? Because for me, I've been pretty consistent through the years in saying that it's not a career achievement award. And this goes back to, I mean, I first started doing these when Bobby Bowden and Joe Paterno were still coaching. But it was pretty obvious at that time they were no longer among the top coaches in the sport, so I wouldn't have them in there. It's not a career achievement award. And I weight recent performance pretty heavily, with in particular focus on the past three seasons, because I think that tells you more about who the best coaches are today rather than, let's say, of the 2010s.
For me, it's pretty much everything I can think of. And for instance, Jim Harbaugh really did a terrific job in the NFL. I think that does I think about that when I think of how good of a coach he is. The 49ers were spinning their wheels when he took over, and he got them into a Super Bowl, and he got them good right away. I think of the impact Mike Leach has had on the sport of football. It's not just he won a lot of games, but he has had a profound impact on how the sport is played. I think Chip Kelly has had a profound impact on how the sport has played and how people schedule. And I'm not talking about like who you play on your schedule. I'm talking about how teams prepare and the sports performance piece of that. So I think those are also elements in that. Just like, I don't know how, I didn't count up how many non-Power 5 you guys had, but I do think, you know, we look at it, say, okay, what was the situation this coach took over? What did they do there? And to me, it's not necessarily all about that. One thing I'm kind of dicey on is, oh, this guy had 9 top 10 ranked recruiting classes. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about what you do on the field more than, you know, how you recruit. Now, if it leads to that, that's great. But so it's kind of a, I don't know, it's kind of a moving target. And then what I end up doing is I really look and say, okay, I start slotting guys. And then over the course of a couple of plane flights and downtime, I start moving them around, say, how does this look? Or do I think this person over that person? And invariably, they'll be like what I think you do, where you probably have 3 or 4 or 6 guys. You're like, man, this guy's not going to make my list. And, you know, so here we are. I thought, you know, like when I looked at your list, when you sent it over to me earlier tonight, I was like, there was one that kind of surprised me because I was like, wow, you have this coach way further down than I do. And I don't know if you're wrong. You know, it's just like, I feel like I could defend most of these. And that's how I wrote the text around it. But, you know, I'm interested to hash it out with you.
Okay, so we have the same top two, Nick Saban, Dabo Swinney. You put Saban 1, Swinney 2. I feel like they are equals at this point. So I just say 1A and 1B. And then this one, so you've been higher on this coach than me probably for, I don't know, going on 3 years at this point. I'm pretty high on him. He's in my top 10 now, but you have him number 3. And that's James Franklin.
Okay, so it's interesting because when I looked at what you wrote about James Franklin, where you have him number 7, you don't mention at all what he did at Vanderbilt. And when I think of James Franklin, I think that's a big piece of why he's as high up as he is. And when he took over Vanderbilt, it was his first head coaching job, and they had been horrific for a very, very long time. He was there 3 years and had 2 top 25 finishes. Vanderbilt hadn't been in the top 25 in over 60 years before he got there. And after he left, they've been pretty bad again. They have had 6 straight losing seasons under Derek Mason. So, and then he gets to Penn State. And look, I think Bill O'Brien did a good job of laying the foundation and building them back up. But it was heavy sanctions, and it didn't take him long to win the Big Ten. And he's in a loaded division in the Big Ten, by the way. And I just think, you know, people can say, okay, well, he's made some just in-game decisions that they're in, you know, apoplectic about. But when you look at what he's done at Penn State and certainly at Vanderbilt, it's hard for me to find 5 coaches better than him. You know, it's interesting because the coach you have number 3 is the coach I'm probably most familiar with. And I have Ogeron number 4. And I wouldn't be surprised if some people are like, how could you have Ed Ogeron number 4? But I still think even though he won a national title and ran through probably as tough a schedule as anybody's ever had to go through to win a national title, I think there's people who are going to go, well, he had Joe Burrow. Well, never mind that he was the one who took Joe Burrow. Or he had Joe Brady. Well, he was the only one who's going to hire Joe Brady. So I think you got to give him credit for those things. And so what it came down to me between Franklin and Ogeron was just, like I said, Franklin, I think, has done a terrific job at 2 places. I think Penn State is still trending upward. You know, I think it was a close call between the two for me. I mean, look, Franklin's never been in a playoff. Ogeron, you know, has done a remarkable job at LSU, and I could see why you have him 3rd.
Yeah, I don't think it's automatic. I don't think you, like, hey, he just won the national title. He's got to be right after Saban and Dabo. But when I looked at not just this past season, but over the last few seasons at LSU, 12-3 against top 10 opponents. It was more than just this one season with Joe Brady. So,
yeah, and it's 11-1 actually in the last 12 against top 10.
That's amazing. To put it, that's Saban-esque. So, I wasn't planning to do this, but a listener question, because he addressed it to me, but given you're even higher on James Franklin, I think you should answer it. The subject from James in Seoul, Korea, Harbaugh versus Franklin. I understand skepticism about Jim Harbaugh, but Stu seems to be much higher on James Franklin. Even starting from 2016, conveniently leaving out Franklin's worst 2 years at the beginning and 4 losses to Ohio State and Michigan, their overall records and recruiting rankings are very close. They're tied head-to-head. Stu thinks Harbaugh is what he is at this point, but somehow Franklin appears to be on the rise, even though he's been there longer. I don't get it. One win over Ohio State 4 years ago, that was pretty lucky, by the way, and a couple more wins overall seem to be the only substantial differences.
Okay, so look, I think there is some parallels here. Jim Harbaugh did an amazing job. You remember how horrible Stanford was, and in 4 years, not only did he beat Pete Carroll, but he had he won a BCS Bowl. I thought he did an amazing job there. I thought about this. I think I had a conversation with our friend Max Olson in the last week about this, about Harbaugh is defined by the arch rivalry against the only school that really matters if you're the Michigan coach. He has not won it. The last 2 years, he hasn't been close. They've been blowouts. The game where there is the questionable ruling of the first down or not, or the distance, if he somehow wins that game, I think we think of Jim Harbaugh's run at Michigan completely different. But the fact that he has not beaten them, I think, holds very heavy. To say that James Franklin or Penn State was lucky, you know, I don't want to hear about lucky. You won the game or you didn't win the game, right? So he did win that game. It was a huge win for him at the time, because at that time, a lot of people were really going, I think they were down that he wasn't Bill O'Brien, and what was, you know, they were frustrated with a lot of things there. That was a program-changing win. And, you know, he backed it up. He won the Big Ten title. So he has accomplished some things that Jim Harbaugh just hasn't accomplished there. I mean, if you'd ask me, I think Vandy is a tougher place to win at than Stanford. And so I would, you know, as great a job as Jim Harbaugh did at Stanford, I would think what James Franklin did, especially considering that till last year, David Shaw kept winning at Stanford, whereas as soon as James Franklin left, it was like back to sucking at Vanderbilt.
The people who are down on James Franklin or think we're overrating him, I think I don't really understand, given how much coverage the Penn State Jerry Sandusky story got, why it's kind of now forgotten in history how severe those sanctions were that James Franklin walked into. It wasn't like, I mean, those sanctions came down in 2012. He got there in 2014. Now, they ended up ending the bowl ban 2 years early, but the damage had been done in recruiting and from scholarships. So for him to go from that to winning the Big Ten 2 years later, and then if you look over the past four seasons, he's won 11 games three of the past 4 years.
In a really, really tough division, by the way.
Do you know how many times Jim Harbaugh has won 11 games at Michigan?
Zero.
Zero. Yeah. So, yes, they've had some, you know, on the field, if you're just going solely by the times when they've coached against each other, it's been very even. But if you're looking at what each has accomplished over their tenure there, I don't think it's particularly close. The Vanderbilt thing, well, I'll get into this a little bit with some of the other coaches, but I think basically, look, when I first started doing, after Harbaugh got hired at Michigan, I think I had him as high as third or fourth
in
the country.
Yeah, I would have had
because
him
of
he
what
took,
he did at, yeah, because of what he did at Stanford and the 49ers. And then as time has gone on, and his Michigan run just has not been as.
And by the way, his first year was a lot better than I think most people thought it was going to be at Michigan.
I always say, and I'm sure I'm going to be getting flooded with Harbaugh comments for not having. I don't have him in there.
You don't have him in there at all, do you?
No, well, I didn't have him in there last year, so I don't know why he would have worked his way in. What I always say is, okay, 25 out of 130. It's the top 20% of coaches in the country. You would to qualify for that, you have to be regularly exceeding expectations relative to the job you're at. And that, you know, that tends to favor overachiever types, right? Like, you know, guys who are winning at a high level at schools that don't usually win. But even at the powerhouse programs, you know, I mean, Saban is obviously on here. Like, Kirby Smart is high up here. Harbaugh, that first season, I guess you would say he exceeded expectations, but not as a whole. I mean, he was hired and with all that fanfare, and he has one of the highest salaries in the country to win Big Ten titles and play for national championships, and he hasn't come to that. He hasn't done it. So that's my reasoning there.
Fair enough. I want to ask you about this one, and again, this is what I alluded to earlier in the podcast. There was a coach that I have pretty high up. I have at number 6, and I looked for him and looked for him, and you have him all the way down at number 14, and that is Jimbo Fisher. Who's right here?
Jimbo Fisher was the hardest one for me because of what I said earlier. If you're going like more long-term, bigger picture, career achievement, whatever you want to call it, he's a national championship coach. How many national championship coaches are there right now? 5?
Mac Brown's in there. Les Miles are in there.
All right. We've added them back in. So that alone, and then of course, just the whole run or most of the run at Florida State was at a very high level. But the last 3 seasons that Jimbo Fisher has been a head coach, 5-6 at Florida State. He left town before the last game. 9-4 his first year at A&M. 8-5 his second year at A&M. Those are his last 3 seasons. Just at this point, I feel like he has to earn his way back into the top 10. I can't just, because I had him, I think, 6th or 7th last year. I can't just keep him there on the promise of $75 million contract, great recruiting classes. It's coming at any moment. We don't know if it is. Maybe it will. Maybe they'll break out and have a 10, 11 win type season this year, and we'll all remember why Jimbo got this reputation in the first place. But right now, who has accomplished more in the last 3 years, him or Kyle Whittingham?
I'm not going to argue with Kyle Whittingham. I actually have him in my top 10. You have him 11. Yeah, it's interesting because I'm looking, like, you have a couple of names in there. I was like, whoa, you have Bill Clark in the top 10. And that surprised me. Now, look, I know it's a really tough job. He's worked some wonders there. But that still surprised me to see him in the top 10.
Do you have Bill Clark in your top 25?
I do not.
All right. Well, that's a pretty... So there's two guys who one of us has in the top 10 or very close to it. And for you it's Gary Patterson, number 11, who the other person doesn't have at all.
You took Gary Patterson completely out of there?
Yep. Gary Patterson has, again, kind of like D'Antonio, Shaw. He was just a default top 10 pick for me for many, many years. And nobody could question what a tremendous run he's had at TCU. But over the last 4 seasons, I mean, they've been...
Well, he had one really good year in there.
Yeah, so the last...
3 of the last 4 have been shaky.
2016, 6-7. 2017, 11-3. 2018, 7-6. 2019, 5-7. So again, if you're talking about best coaches in the sport right now, I think Gary Patterson has kind of lost that benefit of the doubt. I mean... a good question for you would be, okay, if you feel like, you know, Gary Patterson has accomplished so much that even with these last couple of down years, he should still be number 11. Okay, I can buy that. If Mark D'Antonio hadn't retired, where would you have him? Because I feel like they're kind of similar.
I would have Mark D'Antonio somewhere in the back end of the top 25. But he is, to me... Mark D'Antonio was running on more fumes than I feel like Gary Patterson's still close to on top of his game. And I can't dismiss this. Like, I was looking back at this. He's had 7 top 10 finishes since that same stretch. A&M and Texas, which have way better resources than TCU, have had 2 less top 10 finishes than TCU.
Yeah, I don't feel like people have thrown in the towel on Gary Patterson like they had.
To me, this is not Les Miles we're talking about here. I think Gary Patterson still has his fastball. I saw Gary Patterson flat out coach Tom Herman in a game we did earlier this year, last season, I guess it is now.
That was the high point of their season.
It actually was. They picked off Sam Ehlinger 4 times, and again, I think some of it was they've had some real challenges on offense. And I don't know. I'm surprised. I didn't even realize you didn't have him in there. I mean,
so for frame of reference, in 2018, I had Gary Patterson number 5 in the country. Last year, I had him number 9.
You think he just forgot how to coach?
I don't think he's forgotten how to coach, but I'm discouraged to see. Like, you keep saying he's still at the top of his game, but they've actually gotten worse. Last year was their first losing season in, I think, since, what, his first year in the Big 12? Second year in the Big 12, maybe? I mean, it's he's got to get he's got to get a productive quarterback. He's still on top of his game for the most part is defense every single year.
That's it. He's as good as there is at this. You're going to wake up on Friday morning when this podcast is up and running, and it's going to get a DM that's just going to say GFY.
I mean, other than the 2 years of Trevon Boykin, they've been pretty shaky on offense. Now, he made some interesting staff changes this year. It'll be interesting to see if they can get it going again next year. Jerry Kill is there now as like an offensive coordinator who's not an on-field coach. He's in charge of the offense, but he's not one of the on-field coaches. And then this is fascinating to me. You remember those great years of Trevon Boykin? It was co-OCs, Doug Meacham, Sonny Cumbie. Sonny Cumbie has been there throughout. Doug Meacham is back, but not as a co-OC, as a position coach.
By the way, from looking at my list compared to yours, it really dawned on me that I am much more bigger picture than you. You seem to be way more fluid in your rankings.
Yeah, I move people around quite a bit from year to year. Like I said, it's...
I mean, you just dropped them way... Like, honestly, I thought I was going to drop Gary Patterson further than I did. I think I dropped him 2 or 3 spots from last year. I thought I was going to drop him like 6 or 7 spots. You know, I just didn't make big sweeping moves.
At first, I would say, for a while, I would try to say, don't overreact too much to one bad season. And I try to do that. But at the same time, this is a sport where if you have 2 bad seasons, you get fired. People's perceptions of these coaches change pretty rapidly. So I think that my rankings are fluid. Kind of accordingly, right? Like if Gary Patterson has another bad season this year, he's not going to be in your top 25 next year.
You have Jeff Munkin at 17. He just went 5-8.
Well, I had him even higher last year.
I know, but it's not like I'm surprised you still had him because he went 5-8. And it's not like Jeff Munkin has had like 7 great years there. He's had, you know, 3 really good seasons, but it's not like, you know, he's had this Gary Patterson run, and then he goes 5-8, and you still have him 17. That surprises me a little
bit. Yeah, it seems pretty clear in our conversation here that I'm more micro-focused on the past 3 or 4 years, and you're maybe you continue to view guys from a more bigger picture perspective, and that's fine. I had Jeff Monk at number 11 last year. It still is a remarkable, remarkable turnaround. They average for about 2 decades there, they averaged 3 wins a year. Then from 2016 to 2018, they go 8-5, 10-3, 11-2. They had a setback year this past year. There's no question about it. And frankly, it was puzzling from a distance because we all watched that Michigan game where they took them to overtime, and then they end up going 5-8. But I wasn't going to drop them out of the top 25 because of that.
You know what surprised me? I was surprised how high you have Mario Cristobal. You have him at 13. I think I have him at 23 or 24, but my rationale was I think he's done a good job and he's recruited well, but he's really had one really good season, and it was last year.
I was surprised. I thought, you know, you follow him in that program very closely. I'm not sure where I thought you'd have him, but I definitely thought it'd be higher than barely in the top 25.
Yeah, it was hard because I think he's going to have a really good year this year, and I think he has a top 10 team there. And, you know, they won a Rose Bowl, but it was really, the year before that, we did their bowl game, and it wasn't like an amazing turnaround there. So
he's kind of the king of the Pac-12 right now. But look, I mean, I have Kyle Whittingham 2 spots higher than him, even though they crushed Utah in the bowl game. I mean, in the Pac-12 championship, and Utah still hasn't won the Pac-12 like Cristobal just did. But there's one where you have to kind of take into account the longer track record. Kyle Whittingham's been winning and winning consistently there for a long time. Cristobal is more recent.
I was struggling to find people for the 9 and 10 spots or 11 spots, but I have Whittingham 9, and I found a stat that is really, I think, illuminates just how great a job he's done there. He's had 2 top 5 finishes and 7 top 25 finishes in the history of the school before he took over. They only had 2 other top 25 finishes.
And one would have been the year before with Urban.
Urban, right.
Actually, I think both years he would have been in the top 25.
I thought there might have been a McBride year, but okay. Maybe not.
A guy that we both seem to be pretty bullish on is Scott Satterfield. You have him 10th. I have him 18th. I did. He's one of the. There's a group in there from about 15 to 20, 21 maybe, that I moved around quite a bit. Mark Stoops was in that group.
I was surprised you had him as high as you did.
I think Mark Stoops is starting to, you know, it was one thing after that 1-10-3 season to say, I remember I debated whether to have him in there or not last year, but now you see what he followed it up with basically one hand tied behind his back with a receiver playing quarterback.
Here's my question on Mark Stoops, though, was I was on the fence with him, and then I looked, and I was like, he's been there for 7 seasons, and he's only had 1 year where they had a winning record in the SEC, and they're in the easier side. So I think he's done a really good job there, and he's gotten it. It's just like, at that point, I was like, you either had to have done something great and made playoff runs or something, or you've had to, I think he's outperformed where he's at, but I don't think he's like outperformed. Like what Satterfield did last year was pretty amazing. I remember going there in the offseason and knew how horrible that what Petrino left behind, and to turn it around like that. And he had already done a really good job at App State. So I was comfortable with him there. But again, I mean, some of these are, you know, like, I mean, I look and it's like, I feel like we have PJ Fleck in roughly the same spot. You know, we have some of these where there's quite a bit of overlap. I think you had Paul Christ higher than I did. And, you know, where I said earlier you had some group of 5 guys, I have Lance Leipold from Buffalo at 20, you know. So
yeah, you may be grading Mark Stoops on a bit of a harsh curve there. It's Kentucky. It's Kentucky football.
No, I get it.
In fact, the stat you just brought up about only 1 winning season in the SEC, remember Rich Brooks? You think of him, you know, the run. He had a decent run there the year where they – you know, there was a year where they beat LSU and LSU was number 1 and they were in the top 25. Rich Brooks never had a winning record in the SEC. And in fact, he did have 4 straight bowl seasons, which is great. But he finished his time there 16-40 in the SEC play. Stoops, a little bit better than that, 20-36. So it's a tough, tough job. I think he's earned a lot of respect over the last couple of years.
Fair enough.
You want to set the stage for the big Kirk Ferentz news?
Okay, so I'm reading how you wrote this, and I'm not surprised to see him in there. I did not realize the history you had with Kirk Ferentz.
Yeah, Iowa fans have never forgiven me for my history. So I've only done a worst coaches list a few times, and I always regretted it after the fact.
Because, what was the rationale on that?
Well, it would have been like, that was when it wasn't even its own column. That was just a mailbag. Somebody would ask like 5 best and 5 worst. And by 5 worst, I meant like, I mean, I remember Carl Durrell was in there when he was at UCLA, and Al Groh when he was at Virginia. And like guys who were Chan Gailey, like kind of underwhelming Power 5 coaches. And in 2013, and I only brought it back for 1 year, Kirk Ferentz was coming off a 4-8 season. They pretty much like, I mean, that program had fallen into a rut. And so, and he was, you know, kind of known for the big, ridiculous contract. So, yes, I put him in there and immediately regretted just doing the list at all, because it always becomes a story. It shouldn't be a story. It shouldn't be, beat writers shouldn't have to be writing about who Stuart Mandel ranked as one of the worst coaches. But that is exactly what happened. And then he had came back the next year and had a pretty decent year. Now, for most of the last however many years, there's been just a complete split on him in terms of half the fan base reveres him and thinks is just so glad to have him and look at what he's done over the 20-something years. And half the fan base is frustrated when they keep going 7-6 or 8-5 or whatever it's been. I did think their team 2 years ago You had that Northwestern Iowa game where I think that's how Northwestern won the division that year, I think, or at least was a big, like, they were, Iowa should have been much better that year. They had two first round tight ends. That being said, what I came to realize when I sat down to do this list is that, you know what, that rut Iowa was in at the time that I did that, he has...
By the way, those two first-round tight ends, nobody else really wanted T.J. Hockenson. He wasn't like this... I mean, give a credit to them for developing players, and they'll like just...
Well, they do a great job of developing players. The problem was, from 2010 to 2014, they weren't really doing much with those players. During that period, they went... 19 and 21 in the Big Ten. So it was hard for me. So there was no reason for me to be considering him for top 25 coaches. He was a sub 500 Big Ten coach. Then 2015, they have the Rose Bowl season. Then they go 8-5, 8-5, 9-4, 10-3. Now, here we are 5 years later. They've gone 29-15 in the Big Ten the last 5 years. And as our Iowa writer Scott Docterman fed to me, 47 overall wins tie them for ninth nationally over the last 5 years. So I'm here to just officially do my 180. Kirk Ferentz is now a top 25 coach.
Have you ever dealt with Kirk Ferentz, by the way?
Just a little bit. I haven't had a lot of reason to go I can't remember the last time I was there. It was a long time ago. Might have been the Ricky Stanzi days.
My a little aside to this, Iowa is one of my favorite places to go for a football game. It's not easy for me to get to, but it's very, there's a charm and there's a coziness there. And Kirk Ferentz became one of like my favorite coaches to deal with. I had no relationship with him, it wasn't like I had a bad one. I just didn't really know him. And then when you sit down with him, at least on the TV side for these production meetings, nobody is better than them. He is engaging and extremely warm, and just he's really almost impossible not to like when you leave there.
To be clear, I never not liked him as a person.
That's okay. I wasn't saying that.
Well, no, but people,
I wasn't accusing you. I'm trying to. Yeah. Docterman did a story for us, I think it was, probably last winter, you know, 14 months ago, and it was basically doing an interview in Ferentz's office, and I was like, yeah, this is him. It kind of gave a window into that. And I could, you know, I can totally see why lots of coaches really respect him, because I just think there's just I don't know, I'm not describing it great, but he's very engaging and he's very warm. And I'd be lying if I didn't say I don't, you know, think of him slightly. It's hard to, you know, if there's somebody you really respect, you'd probably weigh that in a certain way. So.
Yep, they. First of all, you, it is very warm and hospitable. And in fact, Iowa has, in my recollection, Iowa has the best press box meal in college football. They want to feed you. They want you to go away talking about the great food in Iowa City. And
if you want to get a great deal on like a dozen shots of Jameson, you can go to Donnelly's Pub and it'll cost you next to nothing to do it. So
there you go. That's the kind of intel you only get from Bruce Feldman. And of course they now have our favorite tradition in college football. I know it's only like a few year old tradition, but the wave at the end of the first quarter to the Children's Hospital next to the stadium. So just everything is coming up Iowa these days, and now we both have him in the list. Speaking of the state of Iowa, I think we're both pretty bullish on Matt Campbell. You seem to be more bullish on him than me. I mean, they had a disappointing season last year, and I didn't want to dump him out of the top 25 by any means, but there were a few names that got to the end, and I was like, gosh, am I going to run out of room for him? I kind of want to put my... I mean, I've always had Mike Gundy in here. Am I really not going to have room for him?
Did you not have room for Gundy?
I did not. Chris Kleiman, I considered strongly. But I did not leave Matt Campbell out. I have him 25th.
Oh, you have him 25. I thought you had him at 20.
Here's a great Matt Campbell stat. He has now led Iowa State to three straight winning seasons in the Big 12. In the 21 seasons they were in that conference before that, they had had just one winning season ever.
By the way, another stat on him. He is 3-2. against top 10 opponents in the past 3 years, and he was came within a 2-point conversion in our game at Oklahoma of being 4-1. It's pretty good.
That, all that being said, this is what surprised me. You have him 16th. Fair enough. Okay, one spot behind PJ Fleck, two spots behind Dan Mullen. But you have him three spots ahead of a guy, Paul Christ, who, since going to Wisconsin, is 52-16, 34-10 in the Big Ten, has played in the Big Ten title game three times in the last 4 years, and he has his 7.72 conference winning percentage is actually pretty much higher, pretty higher than, you know, Brett Bielema actually won the conference three times, but his winning percentage in conference over his tenure was 6.60. Why is Matt Campbell a better coach than Paul Christ?
Because when you look at it, Paul Christ got there in 2015. I think he's done a really good job. But in the years before that, it was 11 wins, 9 wins, 8 wins, 11, 11, 10. And then a decade before, you know, like there was a 12 win, a 10 win. And by the way, the division they're in got easier in the last 5 years. So, I mean, I have them in there, but just it's not like it's a gauntlet that they're in that side of it. So, and they're really good now. They were really good before. Like Bielema won 40 games in his last 4 years there.
Yeah, well, that's what I was kind of getting at. Is it's easy. I think he probably gets overlooked, and in fact, he got overlooked by me last year. I didn't have him in there at all when they're.
Wait, so I'm not sure what you're saying. Are you think I am too low at 19, or you're just apoplectic that I have Matt Campbell ahead of him?
I have Paul Christ 9th. You have him 19th. Maybe I'm too high. Maybe you're too low. I just was surprised, given that I almost ran out of room entirely for Matt Campbell, that you have him in the middle, and you like. I just don't think there's any argument for him to be ahead of Paul Christ. Like. We're talking about going 8-5, 7-6.
I just have a ton of respect for him. I mean, it's Iowa State. I just don't think you'd expect him to play. I mean, by the way, even when they don't win, they're like in every game. They don't like get blown out like all the time or anything like that. It's just, I don't know. Again, that's a program I've covered a decent amount, and I just feel like I've seen it inside, and I know how hard they play for him. It's not to say that, you know, Oklahoma State doesn't play hard for Mike Gundy or Wisconsin doesn't play hard for Paul Christ. It's just, you know, looking at that team, I feel like Iowa State is better than you would think they would be. Whereas, you know, the profile of Wisconsin, they've been good. You know, they were good with Gary Anderson. They were certainly really good with Bielema. And obviously they were good with Barry Alvarez.
Yeah, they've been consistent for 25 years, so I get why.
I mean, what was Gary Anderson was like 19
and 7. So I get why they, you know, whoever the coach is going to get overlooked. I just think that we shouldn't take it for granted. I think that they're having a particularly great run right now. You remember they went into the Big Ten title game undefeated 2 years ago. I know it was against a soft schedule, but that's still really good. And then they gave Ohio State as tough a game as anybody did before the playoff. In the Big Ten title game.
Hang on, I just noticed something. You have no Pat Fitzgerald in your top 25.
Well, you don't either, do you?
No, I don't, but I mean, that is near and dear to your heart. That's
well.
And they've gotten rid of your offensive coordinator that you loathe.
I think on the whole, Pat Fitzgerald has had an amazing run there. I think he is coming off a season that would kind of be the definition of bad coaching. Like, they didn't have a single quarterback prepared. They went 3-9. They were terrible. There's no other way to put it. And I didn't want to say this much at the time because you don't want to rain on anybody's parade, but the year that 2 years ago when they won the division, the reality is they weren't very good that year either. They lost all of their non-conference games that year. They had a lot of, you know, last-second wins that you can sometimes chalk up as being kind of a little bit of luck involved. So, I mean, it's not like he's far from mind. He barely missed the cut, but no. And it looks like that's the case for you, too. Like, he was one of your first ones out.
Yeah, he was my first one out.
Well, a similar situation is David Shaw. David Shaw, to me, if you were to say who were the best coaches of the last decade, he would be probably top five. He won 3 Pac-12 titles in 4 years, I believe. He averaged almost 10 wins a year. But over the last couple of years, they've started to regress. slipped down into 8-win territory, and then last year bottomed out. I think they bottomed out at 4-8. So I knew I was going to drop him. I didn't know how far. He ended up 21st. Mike Leach 20th, him 21st. You didn't drop him quite as far.
I didn't. I thought I would have dropped him further, but I just didn't. I have him at 17. I think he was like 12 or 13 the year before. Leach at 20. I'm surprised he's that low. I know he's nuts, but
it's not because he's nuts.
But he is, I mean, man, you know, like, here's the thing, and I'm not even going to bring up the part about, I brought this up earlier about the impact he's had on the game. So Leach had Texas Tech in the top, they finished in the top 25, five of his last seasons in Lubbock. They haven't been in the top 25 in the decade since he left. He had Tuberville, whatever he was doing there, and then Cliff couldn't get it going, and then Matt Wells the past year, you know, is in a rebuild. They haven't had a top 25 season in the last decade since, right? So then he goes to Wazoo, and they are horrific. They are won 9 games in their 4 years before he got there, and he gets them a top 10 season, the first time they'd ever won 11 games, you know. And so I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me not, like, there are not 19 better coaches than Mike Leach. There are certainly more than 19 more normal coaches than Mike Leach, but there are not 19 more better coaches than Mike Leach.
So, obviously, all those things you said are correct, and that's why he is in my top 25 in the first place. I actually had him in the top 10 last year, I believe, or close to it.
You think Mark Stoops and Jeff Monken are really better coaches than Mike Leach?
Better coaches right now. Last season didn't bother you at all? It almost seemed like he'd thrown in the towel a little bit. He just wanted to get out of there and...
I don't know. He had some weird stuff going on with the defense, but I mean, I don't know. Like, again, I don't want to.
The other thing that bugs me a little bit about Leach, what, like, is a little bit of a downgrade, is just he kept getting his butt kicked by Washington every single year.
That is true.
Like, yes, they had a lot of success, but then it would come time to that game, they would get their butts kicked. After last year's game, a little bit of a. Didn't really like the way he tried to blame it on the fact that Washington has better recruits. Of course, that would be a reason why. They lost a game 67-63 to UCLA last year. I don't know. Something about last season, not just having a mediocre record, but just the way it all happened, gave me a little bit of a sour taste.
But, okay, that's fair. I mean, I asked you to defend it, and you did. So
now I'm going to ask you to defend something.
Okay.
Chip Kelly was an amazing college football coach at Oregon. Nobody could ever deny that. But that was now 8 years ago. He has had a brutal first couple seasons at UCLA after a brutal NFL run. You still have him among the top 25 coaches. Defend yourself.
Yeah, and I dropped him quite a bit. I had him in my top 10. He is now 23rd. He had an amazing run at Oregon in 4 seasons. The first 2 years at UCLA have not been good. They're 7-17. But even if you factor that in, you know what his career record in Pac-12 play is? Even with the UCLA stuff?
It's probably still well over 500.
Yeah, it's well over 500. It's 40-14.
Because actually the last couple years at UCLA, you know, they went 0-3 out of conference both years. They played a brutal schedule. And then they were actually 500-ish
in the Pac-12,
not awful
in conference play. Yeah, it's like what happens is they play a really rough schedule. I think he's in the middle of a rebuild. You know, look, there's definitely – I am not as convinced that he is going to have them going to the – you know, I thought they would be a top 15 team this year. I can't say I'm that confident they will be this year. I think they'll be a lot better. I think they'll be a bowl team. But I don't know. I mean, it's not – you know, I think I may have told you this offline before, but I remembered we had UCLA like a week 3 in our schedules on our horizon, but we had Stanford in the opener against your alma mater. And I went up to Stanford on like a Monday with Brock Huard, and we watched them, and I was like, oof, these guys don't look that great. And then I saw UCLA a couple of days later, and I was like, I thought UCLA was better than they were because I had compared them to Stanford, and I didn't know Stanford was a 4-win team. And it kind of skewed me a little bit.
You were right. I mean, UCLA beat Stanford last year for the first time in like 10 years. So That turned out to be correct. But yeah, I think that number 23 next to Chip Kelly is just blind faith on your part. In fact, you gave me some crap earlier about having Cristobal so high. You have Chip Kelly 23 and Mario Cristobal 24. The guy at number 24 just won the Pac-12. The guy at number 23 is been
nothing. I know, but this doesn't happen. I don't think we're just operating in a vacuum where it's like, who just had the best season last year?
I think it's who has had the best recent.
I don't think these people forget how to coach.
How long are you? They don't forget how to coach, but every coach, and I don't know, this could go either way with Chip. Maybe this is the year they break through.
If Monken goes, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
So if Monken goes 6-6 at Army, he's completely out of your top 25 then.
Next year, yeah, he would be.
And if Mark Stoops goes 7-6 or 6-5, he goes from 16 off the board.
I don't know. That one we'd have to, because with Monken, you're talking about now two straight bad seasons.
Your threshold is you give him a mulligan for one.
Yes. But I definitely give you a mulligan for one. But when it's two or even three, because look, lots of coaches, think of Mac Brown, think of Les Miles, like lots of coaches who are really, really good eventually hit a plateau and never come back from it. And you're convinced Gary Patterson is not in that situation. I'm kind of starting to think he might be. Like it all happens to them eventually. So there's no right answer. There's no like, what's the magical number? Like of how long you should, like how long does Chip Kelly keep getting credit for what he did at Oregon, which is now 8 years ago? How long does Jim Harbaugh keep getting credit for what he did with Stanford and the 49ers? The 49ers Super Bowl year was also 8 years ago. Like, I don't know. What's the expiration date on past accomplishments?
All right, Stu. All I know is Andy Staples, you're on notice. If you write one bad story, Stu is going to make sure you cannot expense the next meal you go out on the road for.
One bad story's fine. Two bad stories, come into my office. Just kidding. Just kidding, Andy. Just kidding, everybody. Okay, real quick, one last guy that neither of us had in there. I didn't really, frankly, consider him all that much. I don't know if you did, but our editor noticed this, Dan Uthman. Gus Malzahn.
You know, I considered him, but I looked back and it's, you know, since that run against Florida State to get to the title game, he's barely had one double-digit win season. And I don't think he's a bad coach, but it's just like, honestly, it was like the guys I thought of Mark Stoops, I thought of Harsin, Luke Fickell, Pat Fitzgerald. I didn't think of Gus Malzahn that closely. I mean, you know, like I just didn't. I mean, maybe that's wrong. I mean, did you have any second thoughts on it?
No, the only thing that crossed my mind of like maybe I should include him this year is that they did just beat Alabama again. And he's really the only coach that has had... he's now beaten Saban three times, right? Very, very hard to do. But obviously, you don't judge a coach by that one game every year. And
well, you're judging Leach by Jimmy Lake kicking his ass.
Well, so. in part, yeah. And certainly Harbaugh against Ohio State is a big part of his reputation.
That is true.
Frankly, taking the rivalry part of it out, I actually think there are some parallels with Harbaugh and Malzahn. I think they're both guys who do well enough to make noise and be a factor, knock off some decent teams. But at the end of the day, Harbaugh hasn't won a conference championship. Malzahn won his first year and hasn't won one since. I mean, those are not programs that... I mean, this is not Iowa State we're talking about. These are programs that are fully capable of winning their conferences. So that's why neither of them are in my top 25. At this point, we are probably overdue in saying that you should read our actual rankings if you haven't already.
Give me one coach who's not on your list. I'm not saying you were arguing him for him, but you predict he will be on your list next year. Oh, by the way, while we say this, we both have qualified no Ryan Day because Stu said you had to be there for two full seasons, and he's not, or else he would have been both our top tens.
Just kind of like we just said about one season is, you don't weigh too much on one season, but two, okay. Yeah, I don't want to read too much into one. Ari Wasserman, Ohio State writer, would tell you Ryan Day is already a top three coach. I'm not ready to go there. You did a just miss the cut on yours. I didn't do that, but One guy you have in there that I could see being in there next year is Justin Wilcox. He's doing a good job at Cal, and I think that, first of all, if they hadn't lost their quarterback for a good stretch of last year, he may already be on that list, because I think they would have had a much better record. And I think they're poised to have a breakout season this year, especially with most of the division around them in flux. What about you?
That's it. I mean, you basically said exactly the stuff I would have said. So
you also had Neil Brown on your dismiss the cut. And
I did. Yeah. Neil's in a tricky spot because he took over a West Virginia program that was in total rebuild mode, and I can't see them getting – I think they'll probably be a little better, but I don't think they're going to be that much better. So I think he's a terrific coach, but I think it's going to be a little while before you start to see the fruits of that.
By the way, just not intentional, obviously, but after the fact, I realized that of the guys that dropped off my list from last year, and I think there were about nine, three of them were Big 12 coaches. Mike Gundy, Gary Patterson, and Tom Herman, actually, if you remember the good old days of last year when Tom Herman was still considered a hot coach. So that left only two in there in Lincoln Riley and Matt Campbell. But there are...
Barely Matt Campbell, by the way.
Yeah, so you would look at that and be like, oh, wow, Stu doesn't think very highly of the Big 12 coaches. But I could see... I still have faith in Chris Klieman. I still have faith in Mike Gundy, first of all. I've not lost faith in him. Neil Brown. Like, I think they actually have a good roster of coaches. Maybe Matt Wells will get in there. But just this is maybe a bit of a transition year there. We'd like to pause for a brief minute to ask you, our faithful listeners, to click on the show notes for this week's episode and follow the link that's there to a very short survey. You all know so much about us, whether it's my love of Jimmy John's or Bruce's shaving habits, but we don't know anything about you. The survey is 11 super simple questions and will take you less than 60 seconds, I promise. So head to the show notes for today's episode and click on the link. And now back to the podcast. What do you say we get to the mailbag?
Okay.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. This question from Tyler Hutchinson does give us a chance to address a pretty interesting story recently, which is USC's AD Mike Bone went on our buddy Ryan Abraham's podcast, USC podcast, the Peristyle podcast, and surprised a lot of people by basically saying, when Ryan asked him about would you ever consider going independent or joining another conference, said, well, everything's on the table. And then Dennis Dodd, another friend of ours, followed up with him later, and he didn't really back down on that. Like, he's basically saying if Larry Scott doesn't get this revenue disparity thing figured out, like, we're not necessarily bound here. So Tyler Hutchinson from North Carolina asks, with given those comments, what is more likely in the next 10 years? USC leaves the conference to join a different conference. USC and other big schools go independent, could keep their own revenue, or conference TV deals change in structure to compensate the biggest schools, USC, Ohio State, Clemson, similar to Boise State's deal with the Mountain West.
So it's complicated, I think. First of all, if USC was sitting there going, hey, we're going to go independent, they don't have the clout that they would have back when Pete Carroll had it rolling. Like, this is a bad time for them to do that, just in terms of where USC's profile is right now. They have had all sorts of issues beyond football as well, so it's challenging. I think you look at Notre Dame's money, and it's not like, I really don't think they have that kind of reach. If they did, I think the Pac-12 network would be positioned a little differently. So to me, it's hard for them, I think, to make that push and try to leverage it. I mean, I get it. The Pac-12 is not in a great position either, but I don't think this is ideal timing for the USC to try to make that power play.
Yeah, I don't think being independent, I'm sure that sounds very appealing. I know Texas fans fantasize sometimes about being independent. I don't think that is as realistic as people think. Notre Dame is able to do it because, first of all, they've been doing it forever. And Notre Dame, like them or not, has a very, very powerful national brand. And by the way, Notre Dame, you know, you think if USC is not happy with the money they're making in the Pac-12, guess what? Notre Dame's making even less than that off their NBC deal. They just are a different kind of university that is, you know, has a different sort of model for funding athletics. But, I mean, I definitely think that there's enough instability in the Pac-12 right now. When you have multiple schools, ADs, have complained at one time or another recently about the conference. Like, Andy Staples wrote it, right? He wrote the column saying, Big 12, go get them. Go get USC, UCLA, Oregon, and Washington.
The hard part with that is just the other sports. Those are law. You know, the USC-Texas Tech game, you know, Graham Harrell might love it, but that's going to be a rough trip for them to get to Lubbock.
How about
Texas.
The USC-West Virginia
West
game?
Virginia. I know. USC-Iowa
State.
And
you're talking about football. Not, it's like...
No, the other sports.
The USC-West Virginia about. Volleyball game on a Wednesday night. I tend to think that... Look, football drives the bus in this. And given how drastically and quickly technology is changing... I mean, I think a lot of people are wondering if this next go-round in a few years will even be like traditional TV deals. Will streaming services be leading the charge? Will Apple want to be bidding on the rights to games? We just don't know. I think you might start to see some situations where football gets separated out. Like, what this is just totally hypothetical, but what if Netflix came out and said, you know what? We want to buy the TV rights, the exclusive rights to USC football, Texas football, Ohio State football, Michigan football, etc. You guys can still play in your conferences and all the other sports and be part of their TV deals. This is just going to be a football, elite football package. Like, that's where I could see USC breaking away from the Pac-12, as if it was part of some bigger alliance with other blue blood football programs.
All right, the next question from Rand Carlson. As part of the new one-time exemption transfer rule, why not include an exception to the 25-athlete scholarship limit per year as follows? Every school is allowed to increase equal to the number of athletes that transfer out that academic year. What do you think of this, Stu?
Sounds good in theory, except that that would just be a perfect excuse for coaches to oversign and run kids off. I mean, I think if that were the case... then if you're a coach, why wouldn't you just say, well, these are the 12 kids that I don't want anymore, so I'm going to push them to transfer and bring in 12 kids off the transfer portal.
Right. And so what happens now is, and I remember this came up with a coach I know at a high academic school who had pointed out, you know, if these kids want to go in the portal, they basically are now, we don't have to keep them on scholarship. It's like basically them saying all bets are off. And when it comes, and the reason why I mentioned the academic part of that is just there's, you know, there's a lot of kids where we're going to, once they're into college, I'm not saying, you know, I think most college football recruits probably think I'm going to play in the NFL. But after you've been there probably for a couple of years and you kind of see the reality, if you're maybe it's not going quite as well, maybe you've gotten some different expectations and you're now realizing, am I going to give up this potential degree for something I may not have, and you lose whatever leverage you have. It's not to say the school can't pull out the rug since the scholarships are 1 year deals, but that's the part where I think it gets dicey. And I agree with what you're saying, where I think it just would give, especially the schools on the higher ends of the food chain, the ability to leverage some of these kids and take advantage of that in a big way. And I think you'd have an even bigger gap than we already have now.
All right, we're coming up on an hour here. We're actually recording this pretty late at night, so I think we're going to wrap. Next week, we will have more time to get to more emails, so please. We're actually not getting that many right now, so consider this your invitation to send us an email. With a very good chance it'll be on the air next week, theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time. If you enjoy The Audible, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating if you could, too. It helps us get the word out. Our producer is John Hayes. Our theme song is Dangerous by Kevin and the Octaves. You can download their music on Spotify or Apple Music. Follow me on Twitter at SLMandel. Follow Bruce at BruceFeldmanCFB. And if you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, what are you waiting for? You can get 40% off an annual subscription by using this link, theathletic.com/theaudible. That's 40% off your subscription to The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.